Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and we're going to talk about paradise. The paradise that you're living in. What? It's not exactly paradise? Wait a minute. We're going to really find out if it is or isn't. Because we're going to be talking to the author of a book called Paradise in Plain Sight. And it's actually Lessons from a Zen Garden. Do you know that we all live in a Zen garden? We have to discover that paradise. So that's what we're going to do in this show with the author of this book, Paradise in Plain Sight, Karen Mazin Miller. Karen, welcome to Energy Stew.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm so glad that you could join us because your book is so wise.
Oh, that's good to hear.
And you achieved your wisdom the hard way by facing what was hidden.
Right.
Because it was hidden when you first met your garden.
Yes.
And it's a great story, and it really does read out into all of our gardens. Even though you're dealing with a real Zen garden, because you are a Zen Buddhist priest, and I hate to put labels on you, and you faced the music and learned to dance with it.
Well, sometimes we say that's facing the wall.
Okay. Well,
but we are facing whatever appears in front of us.
Right, and the wall is the illusion of our own inner obstacles.
Right.
And I loved so much wisdom throughout your book, and it really was very, very elevating to read and helpful to see the different points of view that you take from your experiences and also from the Zen masters who you studied with, too.
Yes.
And so you've had quite a journey.
It's a journey of staying in one spot.
Well, maybe we're always in one spot and everything just looks like it's moving around us.
Yeah, that's true.
So let's talk a little bit about what you bumped into to start off with.
I'll just say that I stumbled into this place where I'm living right now, and I mean that in a literal sense, although I do counsel people in my writing that wisdom, I'll tell you this, wisdom works both in metaphoric form and in literal form. That's how you know it's wisdom. So I stumbled into a garden, which happens to be the backyard of the house that I live in Sierra Madre, California. And I often feel as though I was brought here by some providence, but actually it felt like I was continually heading the wrong way. You know, my life was not really going the way I thought it might need to go. But I was brought to this place with my husband. We were looking for a place to live, and we were rather ambivalent about where that might be. But we were brought at the end of a long and unsuccessful day of house hunting. I think many of us have had that experience, to a place that not even the realtor thought was appropriate for us. But nonetheless, it was empty. And it is a little bungalow on an ordinary street in an ordinary town in a suburb of Los Angeles. And the backyard is California's oldest private Japanese garden, a 100-year-old garden, which is about three times the size of my house itself, a very large and old, venerable garden. And we had no experience gardening. And I really had no interest in learning how to garden. But nonetheless, we came here, we saw it, and we fell in love. That does seem to be the way that we engage and encounter with experiences in our life that are most transformative.
And yet you already were living in a Zen world, and this was a Japanese garden, so
I had begun a Zen practice about 5 years previous to that. And so I had that orientation and appreciation for things Japanese. I had my spiritual practice. I had my first meditation teacher. My first Zen teacher was a Japanese master. And the magic of it is that my first teacher had died. I was feeling a bit adrift and uncertain about where my future might lie. But he had told me in one of our meetings together that he had been a gardener when he first came to America in this very place that I was subsequently led to. And so, of course, immediately, Peter, you know what we had to do. We had to stop in our tracks and, you know, face the obvious, which was right in front of us, was that this is the garden that this is the property we were going to buy and we were going to move, and it was all going to happen very fast. And it just became very clear. And I like to reassure people that that's really what happens in your life. You move through maybe confusion, uncertainty, doubt, and you really have to move through it, be pulled through it, feeling as if it's, even though you're afraid and even though you don't know, and then at some point it becomes clear.
And it's being aware of synchronicity, too.
And allowing it to occur. It's actually happening all the time, you know, but we might second guess. we probably do that a lot. And even in our feelings were, until we saw the place and knew for sure, it was nothing that we could preconceive of. It was impossible for us to have planned this kind of a eventuality.
And of course,
it was beyond what we could conceive of.
Right,
but then it became obvious.
But of course, it all went easy after that.
Well, in a way, yes, it fell into place. But then the difficulty comes in that it wasn't a fairy tale. You know, when you live in a place, any place, your life is not a fairy tale. There's no after, you know, where then it becomes, there's a rainbow, you know, and a pot of gold and everything. That's our fantasy. That's our delusion.
To live happily ever after. Right. So this wasn't happily ever after. This was an undertaking that actually was huge. Huge.
Yeah, it was huge. The good thing is we were so foolish in the beginning, we couldn't conceptualize how big the job was.
Good.
Yeah, that's how you fall into these things, you know, because you're foolish. And so being foolish is an essential part of the path.
I like that. We're foolish every day.
Yes, yeah, we're masters of foolishness, but of course we think we're supposed to wise up.
Right. But there is pleasure in each moment of realization of, let's call it satisfaction, of taking the next step.
Yes. And that's the right, that's a wonderful word, satisfaction. And I also think of it as fulfillment. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in Buddhism, we do say, the first noble truth is that life is suffering, and some would more appropriately translate that as life is unfulfillment or dissatisfaction, that nagging, kind of creeping feeling that there's something more that we're not receiving. And so we seek, search to fill that, but when we stay right where we are, cover the ground where we stand, and take care of what appears in front of us, the fruit of that is fulfillment. It's complete fulfillment, because right. We're no longer looking for more.
Right. A lot of people think that there's an end to the path. You know, they're trying to get from here to there instead of being present and just being satisfied with each next step that we can take.
I say, you know, if you think that the path is a way to get someplace, you will never arrive. And there's no greater feeling. You know, when you're on a trip, even though the trip might be exhausting, you know, and maybe it's troublesome, and it doesn't seem to be heading anywhere, you know, fast enough, when you arrive, there is that deep relief and rest, you know, relaxation. Okay, we're here. So, yeah, that's what we're lacking. So we just arrive where we are. And you're right. We say about Buddha, he's still refining his practice.
Yes.
Still practicing.
And sometimes you think, well, when you get older, you'll feel more arrived.
And that's when the path really gets long and steep, because you know where it's headed.
To more.
Well, and if you haven't taken care of your fear, your doubt, the illusion, if you haven't woken up as you're approaching what you know is the end of your life, you're terrified. Yeah, so we don't want to do that. We want to take care of that now. Let's take care of reality now.
All right. Let's try to be satisfied.
And let's be aware and awake.
Right.
And then keep your eyes open.
Yeah.
And experience it.
Right. And I've always said that when we get to the end of our life, we're not supposed to look back and judge, you know, the rights and the wrongs and try to figure it all out. I think we're just supposed to go take a deep breath and go, what a life.
Well, and not only that, keep going.
Well, we do keep going, even if it's the end. We still keep going.
It's like a ride in the amusement park, you know, where you enter this dark, always at the beginning, there's a dark tunnel, this dark passageway, you know, where you really have no idea what's coming next. But you move through that, and after that you move into something that's called the ride.
And actually, this morning I was having a great realization that there are so many levels to being awake, and that's why Buddha's work is still going on. I mean, it's infinite. We are infinite beings. This is such a small micro life that we're in. We don't realize what infinite means, and this is just a stopover. And so every moment is a stopover, and we have to, if we can live in that bigger self, that infinite self, then we realize how much more awakening we need to experience.
Yeah, that is the work. That is the work of your lifetime. That is the work of infinite lifetimes. Wake up, wake up, wake up. Our consciousness is evolving. If we, in fact, we're doing the work, it is evolving. And so, we get to do this work forever. We've already been doing it forever. And in terms of not being able to conceive the infinite, that's why it's called the infinite. It's inconceivable.
Right.
And this is called the inconceivable. The work that we're doing is inconceivable. Now, it's inconceivable at every level, Peter, not just in the unimaginable, but actually the work of a garden inside the garden. I can't conceive of how that actually occurs, really. It's. I can see it, but I can't understand it.
Every process in it is infinite in itself.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's holographic, and fractal.
It blows my mind.
It's fractal patterning at its best, and it's so much fun then to not dwell on size or smallness or bigness, because it just all is. And you had a teacher who taught you about thusness. I like that word, thusness.
Thusness. It's also called suchness.
Oh, I like
thusness.
That, too.
And he would say about it, well, this is really the essence of the entire tradition. That's the teaching of Zen. It's called thusness. And it is, he would say, it is the most profound truth that we can know. And thusness is said to be as it is, things as they are. And you might say in your intellectual mind, in your egocentric mind, you hear that and you say, that's it? I mean, there's nothing more to it?
Well, it's
there's
not...
nothing more, refined or profound than it is as it is. But the practice of thusness or suchness, the realization of thusness is that everything is as it is, complete and whole, at the manifestation of perfection until I judge it.
And we have to get out of that sense of how things are supposed to be.
Yes, that commentary inside our head.
Now, there's something you said in the book that, about this that really I enjoyed so much. And it was when your daughter was 6 years old, and you were, at that point, a Zen priest and a mother. And your daughter was interviewed, and you know, because people have expectations about what a Zen priest is supposed to be like, and they interviewed your daughter about what, you know, about living with her mother, and what did she say?
They asked her, what is it like to have a Zen Buddhist priest as a mom? And she said, she screams a lot.
I laughed so much at that.
Yes. It's funny. Of course, it was also funny in a deeper way because what people were bringing to that, what the questioner was bringing to that was a kind of a precious sense, a preconception of how wonderful it would be if everyone's mother was a Zen Buddhist priest.
Who screams a lot.
And so there she was kind of cutting through, immediately cutting through that expectation. And just stating things the way they are. Yeah, moms scream a lot.
Yeah.
And what comfort I might have taken after the fact in that was that, well, kids don't remember when you don't scream. Because, you know, it's a non-event. My
yeah.
practice, coming back to my practice as a mother, means that, and I'll never know this, perhaps there were moments when I stepped back from the scream. When I refrained from, you know, letting my anger rise up and express itself in an unkind way. But that's, so she's just there calling me to practice. If you have a child, it's your temple bell calls you to practice. If you have a pet, if you have a job, if you have a partner, if you have a neighbor, if you have a garden, it's just your call to practice. Come out, come out, come out, come out, come out of your head, you know, come out of your feelings. Don't dwell there. Get out of your thoughts. Come out and pull the weeds.
And just be present.
Yeah. Do what needs to be done.
And yet, for instance, I've been a runner all my life, and 99% of those runs have disappeared from my consciousness because I just kept going. And
yes.
And yet they
now
were great.
Should.
Right. They were great, often great runs and meeting with great people and doing wonderful things. But I always enjoyed challenging myself to running in the worst conditions.
Right.
Because I knew that I would remember those and treasure those because they stand out.
Right. Right. Well, you learned from them. That's why they stand
yeah.
out. They're lessons. And so
yeah.
we encounter the lesson, you know. We just run head first, headlong into the lesson, into the difficulty. In a way, we're doing that whether we're running or not, whether we're aware of it or not. We are running head first into difficulty because we're going to get old, we're going to get sick, and we're going to die. You know, that's kind right. of the bottom line. So in between, before we get there, we may be detoured or sidetracked. We're heavily into all of our, we really believe in our avoidance strategies. We believe in our strategies. But eventually, you know, maybe it's always going to be right on time, whether we're prepared or not. We're going to encounter what we call hard karma.
Right.
Yeah. And so then what do we do? Well, if we've had a practice, you know, if we have a practice of facing reality, which can be difficult, if we have a practice of facing ourselves, dealing with ourselves, mm-hmm. moving past our self-imposed limitations. That's what you do all the time when you're running.
Right.
Move past your self-imposed limitations. I used to run a little bit, and then, you know, but what I realized is that my feet kept running. My legs ran. It was only my head that wanted to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's our head that is our problem.
Yeah.
you know, it's like you talk in the book about how the garden isn't arguing with us. We're arguing with it.
Yes. I say, you know, the earth does not argue with the sky. You know, the clouds do not resist the wind. Yeah, that only happens in our discursive minds and our reasoning. But in reality, the world is at peace. in reality, the world is at peace. And you might argue and say, but wait a minute, you know, what about all this conflict? Well, those are human beings who rise up with their own wrong-headed views of what they need, what they want, how it has to be. You see, how it has to be. It has to be my way. That's where all conflict originates and where it perpetuates. In order to realize peace, we have to stop fighting and resisting. We have to surrender to the way things are. Now, that doesn't mean it's static and fixed, like, oh my gosh, you mean I can't get a better job? You mean I can't improve myself?
Well, remember,
yes. You do that little by little, step by step.
But remember, you already said that serendipity shows up all the time.
Opportunities keep appearing in front of you. With your eyes open, you take them.
Right.
You don't resist them. What I find so interesting, Peter, is that most of the time people think that what they have to learn to do is say no. And I say, we know how to say no. We say that all the time. No, not me, not right now, not this. I don't think so. We have to learn to say yes.
But also to
see. And then we'll go someplace.
Right, but to be able to see the opportunity, then that you can say yes to. Because there are a lot of opportunities we do need to say no to that don't feel right, but then again, they might lead us to what feels right. So
yeah, well, we have discernment, you know, and the truth is that we really do know, but we have to cultivate that knowing. It's a deeper kind of a knowing because it's based on faith and trust.
Right.
It might be a 180 degree turn for us where we suddenly realize that my life is good and that life is benevolent. But a garden will teach you that. It wants to grow. You know, it wants to flourish and it will do what it needs to do in order to acquire the nutrients that it needs in order to survive. That's really how life works.
And you help
only
that along.
In our minds does it get more complicated than that.
Right. So you're a helper to your garden.
I'm a custodian.
Uh-huh, right.
I'm like a caretaker. My job is sweeping up paradise, but it's paradise without me.
Uh-huh, yeah.
That's what makes it paradise.
Right. And maybe we can all see that if we can, you know, find these paths of least resistance by being awake to the opportunities that show up. And even though it might look like when you got into your garden, it very soon looked like a lot of resistance. You just needed to learn the language of it.
And also understand that not become somehow preoccupied with an imaginary outcome, like the day when all the work gets done, you know, or the day where it looks like a picture in a magazine. It's little by little, just little by little, step by step. And you know, there's such profundity, literally, in standing up and beginning to walk or move through the garden that we live in. And the first step makes the second step easier. And then the third step is even easier. It becomes obvious what you're doing. So I found pretty early on that if I would just bring all of my uncertainty and ignorance, you know, just my, I was so poorly prepared and ill-trained. If I would just step out into the garden would show me what needed to be done. And I'm not talking in a kind of a fantastic way. If I would just look at the spot where I was standing, I would see the weed. And then I'd just pull it.
Right. So what it really is about what is the next step to take. The weed shows up, you take that step.
Yes.
And knowing that there's always another step. And I think maybe one of the greatest lessons in life is to be aware that we can always just take a step. And
yes,
we don't have to take 10 steps. We can just take the next step.
And that is a profound lesson, because what keeps us from taking a step is fear. That's it.
Well, it's fear of the 10 steps.
Our fear. And if we can begin to move through that fear, we've changed everything.
But I think the fear is more the idea of what's 10 steps ahead or 30 steps ahead.
Absolutely. Fear is an idea. I say in one part of the book, fear is just the thought that you're afraid. Because you can't really show. Fear doesn't have a manifest appearance. It's just the thought that you're afraid. Now, you've practiced that a long time.
Yeah, right.
So it's taken kind of a concrete form in your head, you know, and it seems impenetrable. From my point of view, that's why the physical practice of a seated meditation practice or the physical practice of a walking meditation practice is so curative.
It's surrender.
Yeah, and you move. You get to use your arms and legs. You're not having to conjure anything up in your head. It frees you from that. That's your doorway out.
Right. So the more that we can be in the moment, just experiencing our gratefulness of that we still have another step to take, and who knows what happens after that.
Yeah, who cares?
Right. It'll be.
Yes, you'll know. You'll know it when you see it.
That's
it
beautiful.
Always works that way.
Yeah, and it has. And, you know, we look back and we realize, well, I got here. And it might seem miraculous that when you get there to here, but then your mind doesn't trust that you got here so well.
Well, and I even say, you know, the path, if we can play with these concepts or the story, we play with the story so much. But you see, once you realize you're on a path, you realize you've always been on the path, because the path is what gets you here.
Right.
So you don't need to go find another path. You're already on it.
It's just
take
the
next step.
It's the path.
Yes.
And it's not that path. It's the path.
Yeah.
Because that path, then you have preconceptions about what that path is.
And you're thinking, I have to hop, skip, and jump over there to someplace else. It's going to take me someplace else. But all that traveling, all the movement is happening in your mind.
And then you say, if you still have doubt and anxiety, just pick up a rock.
Yeah, that's called reality. Just put it right in the palm of your hand. Put it in your pocket. I've given that advice to people, you know, pick up a rock and... We have a lot of rocks in the garden. Just put it in your pocket. And when you reach that wobbly space, you know, in your head where you say, oh, no, what now? What about? What if? Just reach into your pocket and grab a hold of that rock again and settle there.
Yeah, ask the rock how much it cares. This is so much fun. We're going to have to end the show shortly. And I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I'm so glad that you chose that garden.
Well, and you know, isn't it interesting, understanding what I, or knowing what I know now, I didn't have a choice. I didn't have a choice. In the same way, we don't have a choice except to take care of what appears in front of us, to work with things as they appear. Yeah, so I am glad, too, that I could simply pick up a rake, you know, a shovel, and work with what appeared in front of me, because there was so much wisdom that it had to share. That this is I think that the book, Paradise in Plain Sight, is like the voice of the garden that has been waiting for 100 years. To say, this is what I have to give you.
It was Paradise in Plain Sight, and that's the name of your book, Paradise in Plain Sight. And your name is Karen Mazen, M-A-E-Z-E-N, Miller. And what a life.
Well, now you're in it.
Yes, and thank you. I
so
love it.
Yeah, isn't that marvelous?
Yes, and thank you so much. It's such a joy talking with you. And
it's a joy talking with anyone who's read the book, who has heard the words and seen the sights. So I bow to you.
Well, and likewise, and thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver, H-E-A-R-T, river.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you. And thank you so much for listening.